Hello, and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. One of the miracles of the Book of Bereishit, the Book of Genesis, is that the creation of the world came in on schedule in 7 days, or 6 days plus Shabbat. Unfortunately, Rabbi Meir Schweiger's new home is not proceeding as well according to schedule, and so he is still unable to record podcasts for us. He sends his regrets. He very much looks forward to resuming the podcast series absolutely as soon as possible. In the meantime, this is a reprise podcast of Shoftim that Rabbi Schweiger recorded last summer. Rabbi Meir Schweiger is a senior faculty member of Pardes and serves as a Mashkiach Ruchani, the spiritual guide for Pardes. And now, Rabbi Meir Schweiger.
This week's parsha is Parshat Shoftim. In this week's parsha, the Torah discusses the four institutions of leadership of the Jewish people, namely the court, the priests, the prophet, and the king. In the beginning of the parsha, we start by saying, Shoftim v'shotrim titen lecha b'chol sha'arecha, judges and policemen you shall place to you in all your gates which God is giving you, v'shaftu et ha'am mishpat tzedek, and they will judge the people a righteous judgment. Subsequently, in chapter 17, verse 14, the Torah speaks about a situation where the Jews will come and say, we would like to have a king like all the nations around us. And then we find the directive in chapter 17, verse 15, Som tasim alecha melech, you shall surely place upon you a king. In chapter 18, verse 1, we speak about the Kohanim, the priests. And there we're told, the priests, the Levites, the tribe of Levi, does not have a portion and an inheritance among the Jewish people, because their portion is God. And the last institution is chapter 18, verse 15. Where in the previous verses, from verse 9 on, God tells the people, do not try to emulate, to copy the practices of the nations of around you, who go to soothsayers and fortune tellers, necromancers. Rather, you will have a prophet who God will establish, and to him you shall listen. These four institutions are basically a division of labor among the leadership of the Jewish people. And they are meant to be distinct institutions. Each one has a very clearly defined role. The judges are the ones responsible for maintaining an orderly system, a just system, to adjudicate between parties that are in dispute. The king is responsible to take administrative charge of the people, to be the one to lead them into battle, to be the one who sometimes needs to take extra legal action. The priests are the ones who are totally devoted to service of God. They are the ones whose job is to guard the temple, to service the temple. And the prophet is the conduit, the interface between the people and God. It is very interesting that according to Jewish law, prophets are not allowed to make legal decisions. Prophets certainly are not to be the kings. If anything, prophets are the counterbalance to the king. And perhaps here it's important to note that these four institutions are meant to be complementary and counterbalancing, and perhaps to guarantee that all the needs of the nation are provided for without it going off to an extreme in any direction. In Parshat Va'etchanan, I spoke a lot about the idea of inheriting the land. And that is a theme which comes up again and again when we talk about the leadership. We see it already in our parasha, chapter 16, verse 20, when it says, Tzedek, tzedek, tirdof, pursue justice, leman tichyev yarashtata aretz, so that you will live and inherit the land. The institution of the king is a response to a situation where the Jews have taken possession and have now settled in the land. If we are going to take possession and dwell in the land permanently, it is critical to have a leadership that is able to provide guidance, direction, and maintain the presence of the Jewish people in the land of Israel. It is very interesting that our parsha starts out by talking about the principle of justice as being at the core of our existence in the land. And in fact, I mentioned the verse earlier where in chapter 16, verse 20, it says, Tzedek, tzedek, tirdof. Pursue justice. And it emphasizes twice tzedek. And the rabbis in the Gemara and Sanhedrin derive from this verse that it's not enough to just do that which is just, but you also have to be able to come up with solutions that will be recognized as such. The judges are not supposed to just give us what the law says, but the judges are ultimately supposed to bring about a sense of harmony among the people. When I have disputing parties, it's not enough to just say one is right and the other is wrong, but it's important that the parties be willing to accept the decision. And that's why the rabbis on the verse Tzedek Tzedek Tirdof say, what does this teach us? Pursue compromise. Where the situation can allow for it, try to reach a compromise between disputing parties so that each side will be happy and accept the decision. So that the role of the judge is not only to be able to decide the law. The role of the judge is to be able to create a sense of unity and harmony among the people. If I jump to the end of the parsha, there is a very interesting section, which is known as Egla Arufa. This is chapter 21, verses 1 through 9. The situation is a dead body is found. And note, in the land which God is giving you as an inheritance. And it is unknown who struck this person. It is not just that someone died. Someone has been murdered. We don't know who the murderer is. And then there is a whole procedure which is described. The elders of the city, the judges, are supposed to go out and measure what is the closest city to the dead body. And after doing that, the elders of that city have to take a heifer that has not been worked, that has not pulled a yoke, and bring it down to a riverbed which has not been worked, which has not been sown. And in that place, to break the neck of the heifer. And basically what follows is a confessional, is an expiation, where the elders of the city wash their hands and then say in verse 7, Yadenu lo shafchu et adam hazeh ve'einenu lo ra'u. Our hands did not spill this blood and our eyes did not see. This verse becomes the basis of a very profound concept in Judaism, of the responsibility of the leadership for murders that occur in their midst, and where the leadership has to see to it that such things do not happen. They have to be able to say, our hands did not spill this blood. On that verse, Rashi quotes a rabbinic comment from the Midrash Halacha, which says, How is it conceivable to imagine that the judges were the ones who spill the blood? And the rabbis respond and say, of course the judges did not murder this person. So what are they confessing about? The confessional is that we did not prevent this person from having food and drink, an escort, to make sure that he would not be hurt in any way. What are the rabbis saying by this? It is the obligation of the judges not only to decide the law, but to create an atmosphere of chesed, to create an atmosphere that values human life and the idea of people being in the divine image. From the top down, there has to be the sense that when you have people who are passing through your city, that you make sure that those people are provided for, whether it be in terms of food, lodging, in terms of safe escort. This is in sharp contrast with the society that's described in Bereishit, the society of Sodom, where we have a society that is based on the absence of chesed, where the judges, rather than directing the people, are directed by the people, where the whole purpose of the law and the education of the law is to create a society where people are constantly at odds with each other, where everybody is looking out for themselves. That is not a Jewish society. And so this section of Eglah Ruffah highlights the importance of human life in Jewish society, the importance of chesed in Jewish society, how the judges have to be the ones who are responsible not only for judgment, but for creating an environment of chesed, of kindness. It is very interesting that it is not only the judges who participate in the ceremony, but it is also the priests. We see this in verse 5, where it says, and the priest shall come near. And according to the rabbinic understanding, in verse 8, it is the priests who say, please God, atone for the Jewish people that you have redeemed, and do not hold us accountable for this innocent blood that's been shed. And it is also the priests in verse 9 who then say to the court, Va'ata teva'er hadam hanaki mikirbecha, and you should eradicate this innocent blood in your midst. Which means that the priests say to the court, the ceremony has expiated the crime that's been done only vis-a-vis God, but there is still an obligation of the court to seek out the murderer and bring him to justice, and to see to it that such a thing shall never happen again, so that the priests are the complement to the judges. The priests are in certain ways the watchdog of the judges. And perhaps even more so, if we go back to the beginning of the parsha, where it talks about the judicial institution. In chapter 16, verse 8, it says, if there is a matter of judgment which is too distant from you, then what you should do is go up to the place which God has chosen and come to the priests, the Levites, and to the judge and seek out the matter of the judgment. And the rabbis understand this verse to be saying that whenever there is a matter which cannot be decided by a lower court, then the matter has to be brought to the high court. And where is the high court located? On the Temple Mount. And note in verse 9, it says you will come to the priests, the Levites, and to the judge. And based on this verse, the rabbis understand that there was a preference to actually have priests and Levites be judges. Here is where we have a blurring of the institutions. Perhaps the only place where there's actually a preference to have priests be judges. In this whole parsha, the priests seem to play a central role. And not only the priests, but the tribe of Levi. The reason for that is that the role of the priests is to guarantee the spiritual life of the Jewish people, to be the ones who direct them. The role of the priests is to be the ones who facilitate atonement, the ones who facilitate service of God. The role of the priests is to be the ones who impress upon the people the importance of human life, since the whole role of the priests is to petition God to forgive the people and hence give them a new lease on life. And this is the reason why the priests are prohibited from coming in contact with a dead body, where the high priest is not even allowed to come in contact with the dead body of his close relatives, because the preoccupation of the priest is with life. And that emphasis on the importance of life, the maximization of life, is to set the tone for the whole society. That is to infuse the courts, that the role of the courts is to maximize life. And although in the books there are numerous places where the Torah prescribes the death penalty, in practice, the death penalty was rarely given in a Jewish court, to the point where in the Mishnah and Sanhedrin it says that any court which gives the death penalty in 7 years, once in 7 years, once in 70 years, is considered to be a destructive court. The thrust of our parsha that has to do with inheriting the land places a premium on the sanctity of life and the role of the priests and the judges to further that. The role of the judges to further harmony and unity among the Jewish people. It is within this context that we have to then understand the regulations which begin in this parsha regarding warfare. In chapter 20, verse 10, we're told that when you come to a city to engage it in battle, call out to it in peace. And if the city should respond and open up to you, then the people in that city shall be to you for taxation and servitude. But if that city does not make peace with you, then engage it in war, besiege it. And when God gives the city into your hand, destroy all the males, take the spoils. In verse 15, 16, and then 17 it says, this is what you shall do to the cities that are near to you, to the cities that, excuse me, far from you. But the cities that are close by, regarding those cities, do not allow anyone to remain alive. Utterly destroy them. The rules of warfare ring a very strident tone, a dissonant tone, for modern sensibilities. Utterly destroy a people smacks of genocide. Kill all the males, although a little bit better, still seems to be extremely harsh, cruel. The only explanation which I have to offer is that this is part of some divine judgment where God articulates the reason so that you will not learn from these people and do according to all of their abominations, so that they will not corrupt you. But what I would like to focus on is that the first thing which the Torah says when it introduces the section of warfare is that when you go to war, you shall call out in peace. And there is a very interesting disagreement between Rashi on the one hand and Ramban, Nachmanides, and Rambam, Maimonides, on the other. Rashi's position, based on his understanding of the Midrash Halakha, the Sifrei, is that this rule of calling out in peace only applies in what's known as an optional war, in a war that's waged against distant nations. But when it comes to a milchemet mitzvah, a mandatory war, the war of conquest of the land of Israel, there is no peace option. The only possibility is utter destruction of the peoples living there. Ramban and Rambam, on the other hand, say that the peace option applies in every situation. The Ramban, Nachmanides, mentions that on this verse. And Rambam, Maimonides, says this in the Mishneh Torah, in the Laws of Kings. And this can be found in Hilchot Melachim, chapter 6, where the Rambam says, the Jewish people never wage war against anyone unless they first call out in peace. Whether this is an optional war or whether this is a mandatory war. If the people that we call out to accept the peace terms, which basically means taxation, accepting Jewish sovereignty, and accepting upon themselves to abide by the 7 laws of Noah, then we embrace them in peace. But if they don't, then there is the requirement of warfare. And both Ramban and Rambam quote a comment from the Jerusalem Talmud, which is to be found in Masechet Shvi'it, which says that before Joshua entered the land of Israel, he sent out 3 letters. The first letter said, anybody who wants to leave, to flee, has that option. The second letter, anybody who wants to make peace, has that option. The third letter was, anybody who wants to make war has that option. And both of them note, the only people who exercised the peace option were the Gibeonites. This is chapter 9 in Joshua. Everyone else chose to make war. The Jewish people are a peace-loving people. The Jewish people value life. This is something which we've discussed in previous podcasts. You can see this already in the book of Numbers in chapter 21, when the Jews are going up the eastern side of the Jordan River, where they ask for rite of passage, first of the Edomites, then of the 2 kings, Sihon and Og. And this point is then elaborated on in chapter 2 and 3 in Deuteronomy, where it speaks also about Ammon and Moab. The Jews did not want to engage any of these peoples in battle. And it's only with 2 kings, Sihon and Og, who refuse to give the Jews rite of passage, who gather together an army to wage war against the Jews, where the Jews then fight back and totally destroy them. And those sections set the tone for what appears later on. And it's interesting to note, the Gibeonites in chapter 9 of the book of Joshua trick Joshua in order to be able to make a peace treaty. And there's a whole discussion, why was that necessary? And I won't go into that right now. What's interesting to me, what's fascinating, is that they present themselves as people from a distant land. And the response of the Jewish people is to immediately jump on that. It doesn't seem that there is an exhaustive investigation as to who these people are, where they come from. Immediately the Jews agree, yes, we will make peace with you. And it's only afterwards, when they find out that they've been tricked, that there is an uproar, and then the Jewish people say, let us go now and destroy them. And the response of the leadership, of the princes, and of Joshua is that we cannot do it. We gave them our word, even if it was done under deception. We have to honor it. To fight against them would be a desecration of God's name. We can't do that. And so the Jewish people maintain the peace agreement that they made with the Gibeonites. But what's more fascinating is, in chapter 10, when the surrounding Canaanites hear that the Gibeonites have made peace, there is a coalition formed of the major kings who want to attack the Gibeonites, a coalition of five. And the Gibeonites send to Joshua, defend us, come to our aid. And Joshua does it. Joshua could have very easily said, it's your problem. But what this shows is how seriously the Jewish people are interested in peace, how seriously they treat agreements that are made, and how seriously they go all out to fight aggression. Israel has just made a ceasefire with the surrounding people, Hezbollah, Lebanon. Many people in Israel are very skeptical as to whether this ceasefire will hold. Many are convinced that it is a lapse for the next round of fighting. But the Jewish people are a people who pursue peace, who want peace. And that is what is motivating this agreement. We have to be a people who pursue peace. We also have to be a people who, when we're put to the test, have to be able to wage war. If we don't know how to wage war against those who do not seek peace, we endanger all those who do seek peace. May we always be able to maintain that balance, to pursue peace, but when the need arises, to fight with absolute determination. And may we merit to be able to take, to inherit the land for many, many days, not just to be here, but to be able to live in peace as well. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi Schweiger. Your podcast comments are always appreciated. Please send your emails to podcasts@pardesusa.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.